This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
If they really do feel strongly that they'd like a by-election so they can take a fresh choice about it, given that on the 4th of July they voted for what they thought was a Labour MP and they voted for Keir Starmer to be Prime Minister, and that's no longer the case, then really she should be talking to local people, because in the end, MPs really have to be accountable to the people who elected them.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to this edition of the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, it was reported how a good thing, the successful recruitment of health workers, has led to a bad thing, a shortage of school places for kids, and how people in Canterbury are having difficulty telling the difference between plant pots and ashtrays. Plus, controversial MP Rosie Duffield quits Labour but pledges to stay in the job, thus avoiding a by-election. My name is Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway Council.
Hello.
Daniel Esten, who covers district and borough councils.
Hello.
And senior news editor Nikki White, who will be looking at what's happening in Westminster News.
Hello.
Later on, we'll be joined by our special guest, MP Jim Dixon, who talks about his role representing Dartford, Labour's first 100 days, and what he thinks of Canterbury MP Rosie Duffield's decision to quit the Labour Party. First up, Robert, what's been happening in Medway?
Well, we hear a lot about housing, and a common objection to new developments is around infrastructure to support those new homes, particularly GPs, parking spaces and schools. In Medway's review of school place planning strategy, the authority predicts that some areas will face shortages of primary and secondary school places as early as next September, and some have only just been getting by with bulge classes for some time.
So what's causing these shortages then?
Well, obviously population growth generally plays a role, but the report identifies two key influences. They are new developments being completed, particularly on the Hoo Peninsula. So in 2021, the council agreed to expand the 100 of Hoo Academy on the Hoo Peninsula. But the growth is such that already the increased number of places won't be enough. The other factor identified as putting pressure on in Gillingham and Chatham is an NHS recruitment drive, which has been successful in drawing hospital personnel to Medway Maritime. But they bring their families and children who all need school places in a concentrated area.
So what can be done about this?
The council's exploring options for expanding current schools, as well as possibly building two new ones. And they're also in the process of turning three single-sex selective secondary schools into co-educationals in order to open up more spaces, which will then alleviate pressure on non-selectives. Councillors stress they'll be looking for long-term solutions, not massively expanding for a surplus of children now, which will leave empty schools in a couple of years down the road, and instead coming up with a solution which can cope with the ebb and flow of need as it goes on.
And what have you been looking at then this week, Dan?
So I've actually had my head deep in the planters, or bins, depending on your take, of Canterbury High Street following some litter-related antics at the council earlier this week.
So do you do that for fun, or is there some sort of political research?
So I was at Canterbury Council's Cabinet on Tuesday, where they were discussing tendering a new enforcement contract for waste and that sort of thing. In the process of discussing this, the cabinet member for enforcement mentioned that these planters on St George's Street, which is basically the main shopping street, have been attracting some litter of late. These planters were put there about a year ago as part of a big £1 million redevelopment of the high street. You know, the cabinet member explained she'd recently asked council staff to waive all of the fines that had been issued for littering in those planters because, quote, if they look like an ashtray, people will use them like one. And she then said she was overjoyed that the council officer was one step ahead of her and already decided to waive all of those fees.
And what's the official reason they've waived the fines?
So council press officers said that it was only a very small number of fines that they waived and couldn't give me any specifics, but that they had waived them because there were concerns that the people who were caught littering in this way actually thought those planters were bins.
Do they actually look like bins?
I wouldn't say so. Only one of them actually has any plant life growing in it. It's a little shrub, but they're all full of soil, and they're sort of three quarters of a metre off the ground. So I don't really know how anyone could credibly mistake them for a bin, other than the fact that they have some waste in them. But you know, nonetheless, they're all full of fag ends. And as it stands, you know, nobody's been asked to cough up for littering as a result, even if they're caught.
And what do the people in the street, what do they think about this?
It might not surprise you to hear that they weren't too happy. I had people telling me it was an eyesore, that it's a joke, and that, you know, that the council waiving those fines is ridiculous, essentially. You know, on the one hand, it's just not feasible for the council to, or even necessarily desirable for the council to have legions of enforcement officers on every street, you know, doling out fines to everyone who chucks away a cigarette. But on the other hand, one would expect that if you're caught red-handed enough to be issued a fine for littering, which, I mean, doesn't happen that frequently in the grand scheme of how much litter there is, then you wouldn't expect there to be a way of wriggling out of it. But apparently it's a bit easier than you'd imagine.
So what's happening down your way, Simon?
Rory Love, the Conservative Cabinet member in charge of education at Kent County Council, has got himself really cross over the new Labour government's decision to outlaw the system of headline Ofsted ratings. Most parents will probably know if their kids attend a school which is outstanding or good or maybe requires improvement. But almost immediately after the general election, the Secretary of State for Education, Bridget Phillipson, announced her intention to bring what she calls a school report card scheme, claiming that the present system isn't fair or indeed accurate.
What is really behind this?
Well, perhaps Bridget Phillipson felt the time was right for a change, but I suspect it was probably more to do with that terrible story about the primary school teacher in Berkshire who took her own life after being told that her outstanding school was going to be downgraded to inadequate. This did appear to highlight concerns that the headline rating system was too superficial and didn't drill into the detail, which can reveal many good things that a school is doing beyond the headline rating itself. So head teachers, I mean, let's face it, they live in terror of Ofsted inspections. But will the new system simply allow others to interpret inspection reports and adopt their own interpretation? Is difficult to say. But Councillor Love sees it very differently indeed. He's set against the latest figures, which show that primary, secondary, special schools in Kent are all outperforming the national averages. He just said that the government's actions in doing this are deeply shameful. And he told the Cabinet last week, I think we should celebrate that while we can, because the government has now banned us and parents from knowing those overall results. In a nutshell, while local government is working towards transparency and data, the new Labour central government is concealing from parents information that helps shape their choices of school for their children, and I think that's deeply shameful. But the Department of Education said when they brought in the school reports card system, they decided to scrap the single word gradings because they said it was not fair or accurate assessments of overall school performances across a range of different areas. Nikki, what's caught your eye from the national scene?
Well, it's been the Tory party conference this week, but all the chat has been about Labour again, or at least the shock move by Canterbury MP Rosie Duffield to quit the party. She made history at the weekend by becoming the fastest MP to jump ship after a general election when she resigned from the Labour Party just 86 days after they swept to victory. She issued what was a pretty damning open letter to the Prime Minister. She blamed her decision on Keir Starmer's cruel and unnecessary policies, such as scrapping the winter fuel allowance and the free Israel, which we discussed last week. She attacked the Labour leader for the staggering hypocrisy of accepting gifts worth tens of thousands of pounds while scrapping pensioners' fuel payments, saying the sleaze, nepotism and apparent avarice are off the scale, and that she said she was ashamed of what he and his inner circle had done and what she described to humiliate the once proud party. If you're wondering where she stands on the freebies list, she hasn't received any gifts in the past 12 months, according to the most recent register. She said she also felt angry about what she described as increasingly outrageous revelations that were coming out, but she hinted she's not the only person in the party that feels that way. She told us this week she'd been unhappy with the direction the party had been going, but had wanted to give Sir Keir a chance to show that things would change once Labour returned to power. So was 86 days enough time for him to do that? Some say she's jumped ship a bit too soon, while others are impressed that she's stuck to her principles and acted pretty quickly. However, because she's announced she's going to continue her role as an MP, obviously now as an independent, there won't be a by-election. And that's upset some of those who voted for her simply because she was the Labour representative in that area and not because they particularly wanted her as their MP. In a vote on our website, more than 60% said they thought that that was wrong and that there should be another contest for that seat. Interestingly, though, Louise Harvey-Quirk, who is the Tory candidate who stood against Miss Duffield and was defeated at July's election, she disagrees and thinks that by-elections cost money, and because that bill will be ultimately paid for by the taxpayer, it shouldn't happen. However, when Dan went on to chat to some of the people who live in the constituency this week, most felt that either a by-election was unnecessary or that Miss Duffield should just trigger one by quitting as an MP because she'd probably win. Most of the people he spoke to seemed happy with her as their MP, whatever her political standing.
So you said you've been watching the Tory conference that much fun. What's been going on there?
As you can imagine, it's been a somewhat subdued affair this year. Kent MP Tom Tugendhat has been making his pitch, though, to become the next Tory party leader. In his speech to conference, he called for a Thatcher-style revolution for a free economy and more growth, while blaming bureaucrats for failings in the NHS and warning that the health service is not what people think it is and certainly not the envy of the world. He talked up his record of serving in the army and said that the party needs to focus on what the British people need and be absolutely ruthless about delivering it, from healthcare and immigration to security and education.
So when will we know who the next Tory party leader is going to be?
So it will go down to the final two. They'll be picked on October the 10th, and then the winner is going to get declared on November the 2nd.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Dartford is thought to be the country's longest-running bellwether seat, almost always voting for the party which becomes the government in pretty much every election in modern history. So this time round, in July, of course, it flipped from the Tories to Labour. Joining us now is Jim Dixon MP, who claimed the seat at the polls. Jim, thanks very much for coming in.
Good afternoon.
Firstly, could you give us an idea of your background and how you came into politics?
Yeah, I've been a long-time councillor, so I've been in local government for a very long time, 34 years to be precise. I have been a councillor in Lambeth. I led the council during the 90s, helped to make it credible and bring it back from the brink. We all remember those terrible stories about how poor Lambeth was 30 years ago. Since then, I've had a number of roles looking after the money in Lambeth. We're now pretty financially stable. I've led public health and health and social care programmes across South East London, but particularly focused on Lambeth. And my involvement with Dartford goes back 20 years plus, when I was the Labour candidate for Old Bexley and Sidcup at the 2001 election. I came across and knocked doors for the then Labour MP, Dr Howard Stoat, a former GP and a really great public servant. And what I aspire to do in my role as the newly elected MP for Dartford is to really be an MP that focuses on public services in the way that Howard did.
Mm. You know, I represent Dartford, which is a pretty working class area just on the edges of outer London. What do you hope to achieve for a constituency like that?
Well, there's a lot to do in Dartford, just like there is across the rest of Kent and indeed nationally. I ran on a very clear plan for making Dartford a better place. It's got wonderful people and a lot going for it, and it's the fastest growing town in the UK. Lots of new houses being built, but there's so much to do. So number one is really sorting out traffic gridlock. We have the Dartford Crossing, a wonderful piece of infrastructure, but massively over capacity. And my big campaign is about trying to get a new crossing 10 miles east, which will only be the second crossing outside London across the Thames. And I think that will help to relieve gridlock alongside sorting out rail and bus services. Big plans for health in Dartford, which isn't as good as it should be in terms of the NHS, the GPs. Crime is a problem, and we're going to work closely with the police to sort matters out there. And homes, particularly trying to find more affordable housing for Dartford residents. And finally, a thing we call putting the pride back in Dartford, which is really about the town centre and high streets and really making sure they thrive again.
OK, you mentioned the crossing. The Lower Thames crossing is coming back. It's hoved back into view this week. You know, where exactly do you stand on that? Because it's not a universally popular idea.
Well, as I say to people in and around Dartford, every day that we don't have a Lower Thames crossing, a new crossing across the estuary, only the second one outside London, every day we don't have that crossing is a day where Dartford residents are late for school, they can't get medical appointments because they're stuck in traffic, they can't get to work, and we absolutely urgently need this new crossing. We're going to get a decision from the government this week, actually, so it's nice and topical. The Department for Transport are deciding whether to give it what's known as a development consent order on Friday. I'm optimistic that that decision will go the right way, and then we can start talking about how to finance it, because it's a huge piece of kit, costing $9 billion or so at the last estimate, and we need to find a way to make sure that that infrastructure, which will be great for the UK economy as well as good for Dartford and brilliant for Kent, we need to make sure that it gets funded.
That was something I wanted to ask you about, actually. Like you say, it was expected to come to a total cost of £9 billion. It's the most expensive planning application in history, and not a single brick has been placed, not a single spade has been in the ground. It's all been surveys and paperwork and bureaucracy and planning permission, and it's cost more than the economy of some small countries. Why is it that Britain just can't get things built?
Well, it's taken too long, and so you're absolutely right to say that it's now something like 15 years, and it was the last Labour government that actually decided that they needed to start to get plans in place for this additional crossing outside London. And I think a lot of the delay has been partly a very patient consultation and looking at a whole variety of routes to try and get the optimal route, which inconveniences the fewest numbers of people, protects the biodiversity and natural heritage of both north and south. But also, I think we have a planning system which takes too long to process big infrastructure projects. And one of the things that the Labour government's particularly keen to do, and we see that in their consultation on the new national planning guidance, is to try and speed these things up. And it really shouldn't have taken as long as it has. But I'm pleased that it's now potentially a Labour government, having been in there at the beginning. We've now had a 14-year gap under the last government, that it'll be a Labour government that gives it the go-ahead. And I, as I say, identifies the right package to fund it.
Something else I wanted to ask about this is that obviously your neighbouring constituency, Gravesham, where the Lower Thames Crossing will actually be, also has a Labour MP, Dr. Lauren Sullivan, of Gravesham Borough Council and Kent County Council as well. And as I understand it, her and her colleagues in Gravesham Labour are not as keen on the idea of Lower Thames Crossing, because they think it will basically bring the sort of traffic blight that Dartford has with the QE2 bridge to Gravesham. I mean, is this an issue that you and your neighbouring MP have spoken about? Is this an issue of concern? Or do you think the government should say, well, a new Thames Crossing is in the national interest, so the concerns of local residents need to be overridden by that?
Well, I wouldn't want to speak for Lauren. She's a great neighbour of mine, and we both campaigned together during the general election. And actually, we share an office in Houses of Parliament now, so we're very close buddies. She'll have her own view. Clearly, you have a different perspective where the crossing actually intersects with your own constituency, I'm sure she'll make those views known to you. But what I would say is there's a really big coalition come together in Kent. So the great majority of Kent Labour MPs, business, community organisations, nature organisations, perhaps surprisingly to some people who think it's not an ecologically sound project, but all those organisations have come together in a big coalition saying this really must happen. And Kent County Council as well, so it's great to be working cross-party with Kent, which is Tory-controlled, with me as a Labour MP. So this really cuts across geography, it cuts across politics, it cuts across sectors, because we really need to see this happen.
The complexion of Kent as a parliamentary area has changed markedly, and there are now 11 Labour MPs in Kent, one of whom is Rosie Duffield, who's resigned, so it's now down to 10. But she was elected as a Labour MP. Do you think that she should resign the seat and call a by-election?
Well, just to say, it's very sad to lose a colleague, and Rosie's been a strong fighter for the party over many years, and it's very disappointing that she's now chosen to sit as an independent. I'm sure she will take a judgment as to whether she serves the full 4 or 5 years of the coming term in Parliament, or whether she decides that she ought to consult with her constituents and perhaps think about having a by-election. I think the most important thing is she actually has a conversation with the people who elected her, and they come to a sensible decision about this. But it's very disappointing. Kent had one Labour MP, yes, which was her, for the election. It now has 11. I'm incredibly proud of that. Disappointing that that's gone down to 10. And I'm sure she'll make her own decision about whether it's right to.
But what's your feeling about it, Jim?
Well, I think if constituents want it, and they make their voices known, she should listen to them. But it, as I say, it's not
so
my decision, it's her decision.
If
constitutionally, she can make that decision herself.
Absolutely, we know that. But if there's a big enough clamour from the public, then she really should be listening to them. That's
I think she should be listening to her constituents, and if they really do feel strongly that they'd like a by-election so they can take a fresh choice about it, given that on the 4th of July they voted for what they thought was a Labour MP and they voted for Keir Starmer to be Prime Minister, and that's no longer the case, then really she should be talking to local people, because in the end, MPs really have to be accountable to the people who elected them.
Mm-hmm. One of the other really hot topics at the moment, and one of Brosie Duffield's stated reasons for resigning from the party, is what's being called freebies. You know, politicians and senior cabinet ministers and this kind of thing getting, what by any standard, quite extravagant donations and gifts from extraordinarily wealthy supporters and donors and that kind of thing. Do you think it's right that it's such a normal part of politics that fabulously wealthy people give, you know, free things to politicians, people who are meant to be accountable to the public and only to the public?
I think there's a big difference between someone who's been a long-term Labour Party supporter, and that's Lord Alley, who has donated items to the Prime Minister. He's someone who I remember from the 90s. I've been around a long time. He was a very strong supporter of Labour then. All through the lean years when we've been out of government, he's strongly supported Labour. And he's obviously decided he wants to try and help Labour in his own ways. He's donated to the party itself, but he's also donated these things to Keir Starmer. I think that's one thing. I think it'd be totally another thing if somebody with a particular axe to grind or particular cause to promote suddenly decides to donate to the party in the hope that the party will change its policies or that they'll gain some favour as a result of people donating. And that's certainly not what's happened here. So I think that's very different. And I don't think we should confuse the two. And I think some people are in this debate. Mm. I know the Prime Minister said he's not going to accept any free clothing in the future. So he's made his view known about what he's going to do going forward. But I do think there's different things being conflated a bit here and we shouldn't get confused.
Mm. No, I take your point. And obviously the question about Lord Alley, who's a long-time Labour peer, is slightly different from that of lobbying in general. But I think it's put lobbying in general back on the agenda. And, you know, there are organisations which, you know, are not, strictly speaking, party political, who are quite in the habit of giving free things to politicians. The Betting and Gambling Council is one of the biggest lobbyists in the country. Lots of, you know, music and events running organisations give stuff away, like, you know, for example, Shadow Education Secretary getting tickets to see Taylor Swift and this sort of thing. I mean, surely you have to accept that to the average person who doesn't get things given to them for free, who doesn't earn, you know, an MP salary, it's not particularly good look, especially from, you know, a party which on the back of the membership card says it's a, you know, democratic socialist party and the party of working people. But, you know, working people don't get that much free stuff. In fact, they pay for almost everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think the really important element to this is that it's declared. So you always have to know who politicians have been having conversations with and then whether that's resulted in something being provided to the politician that over a really quite a low threshold that they need to let people know about. And I will certainly be declaring anything I receive. I haven't actually received anything yet that I've needed to declare. And if I do into the future, I will make sure people know that. And then they can make a judgment that, you know, if I've taken some hospitality and people have used that as an opportunity to talk to me about something they're interested in, then people will be able to see that and they'll be able to judge me on what conclusions I make about the way forward in terms of those policy areas. So I think openness and transparency is the most important thing. I think politicians always do, as you say, have to be mindful of how things look. And, you know, people are struggling. As you say, most people don't get freebies in life. And I think politicians need to be mindful of that as they get offered things and make a decision about whether that's appropriate in terms of whether they take it or not.
Interesting. I guess the last thing I wanted to ask is, we've got another election coming up in Kent in 6 or 7 months' time. I think it's next May. There's the county council election. What's the vibe around that? Because obviously, you know, it'll be just under a year after the election of the new government that election will happen. Do you think it will be sort of a local referendum on the government's performance so far? What's your thoughts?
I mean, there's always a real mix of issues at play in a local election. We'd all love them to be purely about Kent's roads and whether they're doing a good job on social care and children's care. And I'm sure those will be in the mix. And I think as Labour, we'll be campaigning very hard on those things. I think people feel the current council isn't doing well. For instance, if you just look at roads in my constituency, we have a collapsed road at Galley Hill Road between Gravesend and Dartford, which collapsed something like 17 months ago and still hasn't been fixed. And that's causing mass inconvenience to people in Swanscombe. I think issues around older people being able to get the care they need quickly of the appropriate quality. Again, I think there's some real issues there about whether that's happening. So I hope those are the key issues. But clearly, the performance of government nationally, how the economy's doing, very, very micro local things in areas which may be beyond Kent County Council's control, but nonetheless matter to people. It might be the performance of their district council, for instance, to do with keeping the roads clean. People people usually sort of allow that to feed into their overall conclusion and then they vote accordingly. All I can say is that we as Labour in Kent will be fighting those elections incredibly hard and we'll be fighting to win.
Well, it should be interesting for us all to follow then. Jim Dixon, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Canterbury MP Rosie Duffield has resigned the Labour whip at Westminster and thus becoming an independent member. But surely there should be a by-election so that she can reinforce her credentials. What do you reckon then, Dan?
In law, there's no obligation for there to be a by-election. The only way one could be triggered now would be if she resigned or if she's suddenly, you know, sent to prison for something or other. And of course, that's not going to happen. She told me that she's not going to resign. She said that if she had defected to another party or the principles on which she was elected to change, then she would call a by-election. That would be fair. But as she's now an independent, she's not going to call one. That's kind of predicated on the assumption that many MPs will voice, at least publicly, which is that, oh yeah, officially, constitutionally, people vote for the local candidate, not for the party. Everybody knows in practice that's not true. People vote for people based on the party. There was some academic research on it in, I think it was the 80s or 90s, that found that in any given constituency, the personal vote for an MP probably amounts to only a few hundred people. I would imagine that's no better now than it was back then. I think a lot of people are of the opinion that, you know, because that's the case, you vote for the party, not the candidate in practice. If you defect or leave your party, then you should be.
If you were speaking as one of her electors and not as a political journalist and not taking part in this programme, what would your take on that be?
If her mandate was won personally for her, then she should, you know, renew that mandate by standing for a by-election. But she won't do that. She said she's not going to do that.
Well, we saw it before in Kent. I mean, about 10 years ago, Mark Reckless left the Conservatives to join UKIP. And the first thing he did was call a by-election, and which he won. But I suppose it comes back to the point about you sort of saying he was defecting from one party to another, whereas she's defecting from a party to becoming an independent. Mm. But surely it doesn't make any difference where you defect to. The fact of the matter is she was elected as a Labour politician.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's what many people in the public think. You know, like I say, what she says is that the principles I was elected on haven't changed. You know, she writes in her resignation letter that, you know, my principles remain the principles of a Democratic Socialist Labour Party, and people in the local Labour Party are quite convinced that's the first time the word socialism has ever flowed from her pen. She's always positioned herself on the right of the party relative at least to the previous leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, even though the substance of her resignation letter is has a leftish tinge in that it's the same kind of criticism as many taking of Keir Starmer from the left. But there isn't going to be a by-election. There's pretty much no chance of there being one, so in all likelihood she will, you know, it'll run out until 2029, and then it's up for her if she wants to stand as an independent there against the Labour Party, or if she somehow rejoins.
Yeah, you know the patch quite well, Dan. Would you say that if she did stand as an independent, or she was forced to, the rules had forced her to, do you think she'd win?
No chance. An independent hasn't been elected in Kent since 1921, which was an independent unionist in Canterbury, and that was before the advent of universal suffrage. Women couldn't vote and there were still property restrictions. No, she wouldn't win. Independents in general don't win. There were only five or six elected in the 2024 general election. One was Jeremy Corbyn.
They were specific to that.
And five
issue
of them were elected on a Gaza platform. Yes, no, she wouldn't win if she stood as an independent, but that's the same basically everywhere.
I admire her for taking a stance so early on. I think it's a brave and a bold move. She clearly knows what principles she wants to support, and it's quite a brave thing to do before the 100 days measure, which most of us look at political things from, the first 100 days of any government or anything like that. So to go early is a brave and a bold move, but I have to say that if I was her constituent, I would be wanting a by-election because if I voted her in for her as an MP, I would still be voting her in at the by-election. But if I was voting as a Labour supporter, then I've got my choice back. And I think it is about making sure that you have been elected for the correct reasons. And if you've stood... And also, I mean, she's saying, well, I still have all the principles that I had before, but she's clearly got some disagreement with the party, otherwise she wouldn't have left. And I think it's just difficult. And personally, I think there should be another by-election and then we can see what everybody really wants.
Okay. Funny, Nikki, you mentioned the 100 days there. I mean, it's quite, as you say, it's quite a significant political landmark. And I've been doing a feature about that this week with my colleague Gabriel Morrison. We spent yesterday down at in Folkestone, which is an old patch of mine, which I know very, very well. But I mean, it has had a Conservative MP down there for literally generations, way before Michael Howard, Albert Costain was before then. And it went Labour. I mean, almost against the odds. It was partly to do with reform, I guess, having a fairly healthy proportion of the vote and booting him out. But having said that, people said that they would consider voting Conservative again at the next election, despite having deserted them this time. And the next election is obviously the Kent County Council election. That's the next election that's coming up. And not very much love for Labour, even those for those who've actually voted for them. We asked each of the interviewees to give us one-word replies about sum up the first 100 days of Labour. And words like failing and the same came up. I know that's two words, but so basically it's, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. They're not impressed.
Could you reasonably expect, you know, any government to have that much of an influence within 100 days, you know, outside of a moment of like national crisis?
These days, yes. It just seems to be that people's expectations and their opinions shift so quickly and so easily and so fluidly that, you know, anything can happen between now and the next election, the next general election, that is.
Well, another 1,400 days between now and then, so I'm sure there'll be plenty more scandals to come, which will keep us all busy at the very least.
Yeah. Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Nikki, Rob and Dan, and special guest Jim Dixon. Don't forget to keep an eye on kentonline.com/politics for the latest news from across the county. You can also sign up to our newly launched politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And finally, don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. All the best.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.